You know, brethren, as a minister over the years, I've been called on, as we all are, numerous times to give comfort to brethren facing a major crisis or trauma of some type in their lives, perhaps a sickness, loss of a job, which can be very traumatic to some people, to most people. The death of a loved one, of course, is a major loss and a trauma, various failures, disappointments that people might have. And I think we all find that some in the church face these times of crises with great courage, and they become visibly stronger and closer to God as the trial progresses, and they just get stronger and stronger. On the other hand, I've also noticed that some in the church go to pieces very quickly. Their faith begins to erode, it begins to dip. They sometimes become angry, some people get bitter, some get cynical. I've had people say to me, in the middle of a trial, Mr. Catherwood, why is God letting this happen? And they don't use that rather calm tone of voice. It's much more emotional. People say, I don't deserve this. And they may not say it, but they indicate it. One man said to me, if God is a God of love, how can he let a trial like mine go on and on and on and on and being ground into the ground? I've dealt with both of those reactions to trials over the years, the good ones and the bad ones. And very candidly, different times, I've had both of them myself. So I've gone both routes. Because trials of different types will continue to come intermittently into all of our lives, I feel the question has to be posed rather squarely. Why is it that times of crises strengthen the faith of some in the worldwide Church of God and shatter the faith of others? I remember quite vividly the first occasion I had a rough time personally dealing with that particular, or those particular issues. It was 1962, so that's quite a while ago, Indianapolis, Indiana. I'd been ordained, I think, a total of about 6 weeks. And one evening around 8 o'clock in the evening, I got a phone call, a frantic phone call from a member saying that there had been a major, a terrible accident, a massive three-car crash on the edge of the city. And a member of the church in his 50s, a widower, had died. His 14-year-old daughter, who was then an orphan, was in serious condition in hospital, and she might not live. I drove to the hospital immediately. I hadn't been in a lot of hospitals, frankly, and it was one of my first experiences with that type of thing. I told the nurses at the, the counter in the foyer, the lobby, that I was a minister, and they then gave me special permission to go into the intensive care ward. Those are not places for people with weak stomachs, and mine was still pretty weak in those days. I saw the young girl, and I was literally stunned. It made my knees weak, and I can still remember the feeling. It makes you feel very shaky when you're not accustomed to that kind of thing. There were tubes running into her nose and her mouth. I'd never seen that before. You might think I was sort of naive, but I had never faced that kind of situation. There was blood dripping into her through an IV. I'd never seen an IV before. I didn't know what it was. I know what it is now. In fact, I've had them stuck into me about 20, 25 times in the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm well acquainted with those particular pieces of equipment, but I wasn't then. Her chest had been terribly crushed. I imagine she'd hit the windshield. And her ribs were shattered, and pieces of the rib cage were pressing, protruding through the skin of the lower abdomen. And there was a very thin sheet covering this mangled mass of broken flesh and bone, and it was very easy for me to see what had happened to her body. And she was, unfortunately, as far as I could see at that point, totally, completely conscious. She looked at me. In fact, she could not talk. Her jaw was shattered, and her teeth were all broken, so she couldn't talk. But her eyes followed every move that I made. Like a wounded puppy's eyes, and you've heard that analogy before, and it's very, very real, just like a wounded puppy's eyes. Very hard to deal with that. I'd never seen that type of thing before. I had a hard time during the 5-10 minutes I was allowed to stay in the intensive care ward. I had a hard time finding a place to lay my hands on her when I anointed her. I had to consciously look for a part of her body that had not been somehow grotesquely mangled or wasn't caked with blood. And it was very hard to find some place to simply lay my hands. I did. It was a very traumatic experience for the very new young minister that I was. I went home after that, deeply shaken and close to physical nausea and very confused. Maybe that was the main reaction I had. Very, very confused. And one question kept pushing through my mind. Why? Why? Why this terrible accident? Why a member of the Worldwide Church of God had died? Why this 14-year-old child with the battered, shattered body? Why? You know, I learned in Ambassador College as a student that times of crises teach us important lessons. And I knew that. I could say that. I could tell people that. I learned that trials build faith and they strengthen our character. You're taught that. I had read that in booklets. But you know, all of the pat explanations that I had learned by heart and memorized somehow seemed very shallow. Now, they weren't, but they seemed shallow. They seemed hollow. They seemed trite. They seemed a little bit too flip and patently insufficient when I looked into the frightened eyes of that bleeding, battered, and broken-bodied, newly orphaned 14-year-old girl. By the way, she recovered, and that's another story. But it was very hard when it first occurred. I realized in that intensive care ward that my understanding of trials and their purpose was very, very superficial. I mean, I had some answers, sure, and a lot of you do too. But it didn't go very far, and it didn't carry me through under those circumstances. I had a lot to learn about God's purpose in suffering. I'm still learning. I don't think you ever, hit bottom. You just keep on learning about things like that. A few things have finally made it through this thick skull as the years have gone by. I guess the question I have, brethren, is what about you? Do you still panic when it gets a little tough to serve God? I say even a little tough. Could your faith survive a major trial? I'm not at all prophesying that you will someday have a major trial. Some of you may not. Maybe many of you may not. But what if you were someday in the percentage of members of the Worldwide Church of God that will? And what about a series of minor trials? A minor trial in isolation isn't that bad. But what about a series of fairly minor trials, but they're coming fast and furious, you know, one a month for about a year? Could you survive that? Could you deal with it somehow? Would you know what the end? If you said why, could you answer the questions? From the beginning, Christ told us to expect a certain number of difficult experiences in life, and I think we have to understand that and deal with that. Lest I sound, though, like a purveyor of gloom and doom, that is not my basic personality type. I also want to make it very clear that trials, according to Jesus Christ, are not meant to be with us all of the time. Sometimes you hear brethren that sort of say that, well, our lives are really meant to be a mess. Well, we're meant to suffer all the time. Well, God is not a masochist. I'm certainly not one. I don't like to suffer. God is not a masochist. And in Scripture, you find, along with times of sore trial, we're also promised seasons, sometimes rather long seasons, of peace and calm and relative tranquility when we get to recoup. And you've all read David's words thousands of times. I don't even have to tell you where they are because you already know where they're located. The Lord is my shepherd. You know that. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. It doesn't say he takes me out to Death Valley in 110-degree heat, you know, and toast my toes for a couple of days. It says green pastures. And there are people that don't want green pastures. They want Death Valley all the time. Such fun. Wow. Now, I said green pastures. I like green pastures. I'm not a big fan of Death Valley. He leads me beside the waters of quietness. That's a recent translation which I like. He restores my soul. You know, we all need seasons of peace. And when we do, God will lead us, as he did David, beside the waters of quietness. And the picture there is of a lake that is mirror calm. I mean, there isn't a ripple going across the surface. It's just totally calm. The waters of quietness. And you've seen lakes or bodies of water like that. Not a ripple anyplace. No breeze. And that is a vital part of God's plan and his promise to us as well. So it is not all doom and gloom and awful things happening, you know, all of the time. And that isn't the focus of my sermons today at all. I appreciate and I need times of quietness. The waters of quietness are very important in my life, and I want to be there quite often. But I realize as well, brethren, that in God's great master plan, there is also room for seasons of testing. And I'd like you to turn to the book of John, chapter 16, verse 33. You find here that Christ made a rather poignant and dramatic statement. John 16, verse 33, the last verse in the chapter, in fact. Just minutes before being betrayed and carried off by the mob, he said this, the eve of his death, John 16, verse 33, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace." And we do. And we enjoy in life as true servants of God many, many long, wonderful seasons of calm and peace. And we all need that. But notice there is another side to it too. God's master plan decrees we go through times of testing. In the world you shall have not continual tribulation. This is not masochism, but some tribulation. But when this occurs, be of good cheer, Jesus said, because I have overcome, that is, I have conquered the world. In other words, he's indicating that he, in that sense, was sovereign over all that occurs in the world. He doesn't lose control of events in our life. There's no slippage in situations that occur in God's plan. He's intensely aware of every event that occurs in your life and mine. He knows exactly what's going on. But sometimes we don't believe that. We think, you know, if something goes awry in our life, that God is probably on his throne sort of noticing what is happening, but he's rather absent-mindedly aware of what is going on, vaguely aware of it. And something happens to us, and God looks down, and, you know, he notices what is occurring, and he says, whoops, you know, I didn't quite expect that. I didn't expect that either. Do you think God says, oops? Now, you say, you drop something, you break something, you say, oops. Do you assume that God says, oops, when you fall or you stumble or something happens to you? I think we have to accept the fact that oops is not a word that is in God's active working daily vocabulary. He understands the meaning of it, but he doesn't use it in reference to himself. Now, in saying that God is sovereign over all that occurs in our lives, I don't mean to imply, brethren, that God himself engineers or designs or creates and causes all of our trials. He does not. We see in Scripture he creates and causes some. I don't know what the percentage is, but he doesn't create and cause all of them. We find that Satan creates and causes many of our trials. Again, I don't know what the percentage is, but a good number of them. You read the book of Job, and I think that is pretty clear. It was Satan, according to the book of Job, that caused and was the direct cause, in fact, of all of Job's trials, including the sicknesses, the loss of his business, that is, the crops, the flocks dying and being killed, the death of his children. I would remind you, though, that even then, God was fully sovereign. That is, he allowed what was occurring. He was aware of what was occurring. It was a part of his permissive will, and what was going on, though he did not cause it, you see, was an active part at his awareness, and he talked about it, and he analyzed it, and ultimately he stopped it and said, this is all. He stopped it. He was sovereign. There was a point when he said, this is the end of Job's trial, and it was over. The third cause of trials in our life is our own personal disobedience and negligence. We've all read Galatians 6, verse 7, that says, in effect, you reap what you sow. So we create, and we cause many of our own trials through our laxity and apathy and errors in judgment, things of that type. I would submit to you that much of the persecution that comes into our life or comes on the church, in fact, as a body overall, is the result of our own doing and perhaps our lack of wisdom, our lack of common sense in certain cases. The wonderful thing, though, is this. I can't tell you what the breakdown is, how much is caused by God, how much is caused by Satan, how much you bring into your own life through your own strange actions and lack of wisdom. Whatever the source is, God, Satan, or yourself, God is intensely aware of all that is occurring. That's the focus of his sovereignty. He is aware of it. He is involved in it. And he will use every second of every trial. And that's what I find very meaningful and very significant. Every second of any trial, whatever the cause, if the person is converted, he uses it in a special, unique, and meaningful way to make you stronger somehow, and to draw you to him if you let him and if you don't fight his working in your life. There are no futile or redundant trials. Sometimes we think there are, but there are not. God never looks down and says, well, I didn't design that trial for that person, and I'm not going to use that trial. I mean, they're on their own. Let them work it out themselves. I'm not involved, you know. There's that member of the church. He's half blind without his glasses. He's left his glasses in the house. The car has slicked, has no tread on the tires. He's getting in the tire, in the car with these awful tires. He's being imprudent. He's going to hit the tree. He hit the tree. I'm not involved with that. Now, is that how God reacts to trials we bring on ourselves? No. And we do bring some of these trials on ourselves. God enters into them all in a special way. We'll talk about that as time goes on. And I'll tell you a little bit later just what occurs when he does get involved, because he always does. That's his promise. At this point, I want to stress your part and what you should do and what you should know about your trials, and we'll get back to how God reacts in a couple of minutes. Over the years, I've analyzed or tried to what motivates those who grow in times of testing and those who crumple in times of testing, and you do find a kind of a commonality. There are certain common traits on both sides. Now, those who are overwhelmed invariably lack certain elements of understanding about God and God's plan and the way God works and how God views us. And I want to try to sort of sum that up as much as I can this afternoon. First of all, I'll try to isolate some of the big lessons you've got to understand to make it through a trial. That is, to survive spiritually intact. Not just to survive, but to survive spiritually with your spiritual life intact, and then to continue growing through a period of time when it is your time for a season of testing. Lesson number one, and maybe I should call it big lesson number one. In my mind, it is a very important lesson. And it's quite long, so if you're writing it out, you've got a lot to write, but that's up to you. Here goes. When a major trial occurs, it's natural to get depressed. And in the depression, it is natural to express some anger to God. I'm not recommending you do this, by the way. I'm just saying it is natural. I wish you wouldn't do this. I'm just saying you probably will. But notice, brethren, though all these things are natural, if you hang on, these times of depression and anger and confusion that seem to be there almost always initially in major trials, they're invariably followed by times of serenity, peace, and a kind of a joy that God says only comes in the aftermath of a major trial. And that latter part of the statement, you can expect it to occur, and it is a promise you can hang your life on, and maybe someday you will need to. You know, even secular mental health specialists will tell you that a certain level of depression is a natural emotional response to stress or a major loss or a major sickness or persecution or failure or the loss of a job or whatever you want to think about that really affects you, that is a major trial in your life. The Bible concurs with that. Some of you may be surprised by that statement. The Bible, in effect, says it is perfectly normal to experience some depression in times of trial. The danger only exists if it persists and goes on and on and on and on and on, and then you begin to wither spiritually, and it begins to slow you down, and then ultimately it will begin to hurt you. But initially, at least, it is probably going to happen to almost everybody. But you can cut it short, and you can move on to another stage that I've already alluded to briefly at the beginning of point one. I need to prove first that it's a natural phenomenon. I need to do that because some of you think it isn't. And some of you perfect people who've never had any trials in life at all, of course, everything has gone great for you, and you know, good jobs, good health, good everything. People like that, they don't irritate me anymore. I know they're there, and it's not your fault, I guess. But you don't understand this, you see. You're sitting there thinking, let's see, you know, it's going over your head 10 miles high. Oh, well, some people assume all depression is sinful. They assume that, you know, if you get sort of down when things get rough, that something ominous and ugly is happening. Maybe you should counsel for rebaptism. And they say things like that, you know. You feel like Quasimodo sometimes when, you know, people look at you and they find that you're not having what they think is a perfect reaction. People that have that reaction have never had a major trial themselves. So I'm at the point where I just sort of say, well, they want to act like that and think like that and, you know, be sort of intolerant and simplistic. That's what happens when you just sort of sail through life easily. That's okay. You know, our time comes. Because these fittings, though, are so prevalent in the church and have been over the years, most people who get depressed over a trial will end up feeling so guilty about the depression that the depression itself becomes a bigger trial than the trial that originally caused the depression. Are you following what I'm saying? You know, that of itself will bother them. They'll think, what's wrong with me? I ought to have faith and just sort of stand here and take it, you know. I ought to stand and smile and show my teeth and say, hey, my life is falling apart all around me, but I'm happy. Well, I see people that say those things, but they've never had a major trial. And your life is falling apart all around you. You're not going to be very happy at the beginning. until some things began to happen. We'll talk about them in a minute. I want to tell you a little bit about Job. Job, 10 chapters, at least 10, I counted them, the book of Job describe an embarrassing and at times rather melodramatic model in detail, the major depression, we're talking major depression Job plunged into in the middle of his major trial. When you read through Job, I mean, you know, this is a man's man. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. Strong. Boy, did he get down. I mean, the whole book reads like, the script of one of the soaps. And as the world turns. And, is that the name of is that the name of it? As the world turns? No react? Yes? Obviously, you must watch it if you know what the name of it is. I was curious how many people, there was a trap, you see. I wanted to see how many people would say yes. I set you up, and I know who you are. You could take the book of Job and sell it to the people who write As the World Turns. You could call it As the Land of Uz Turns or whatever. And, they would probably buy it. You know, Job's wife would probably be named Laura or something like that. That is invariably the name of the ladies in the soaps for some funny reason. I don't know why. This is a strong man. Job chapter 7, I want you to see what a strong man does. A real strong guy. When he has his first major big trial in life, what happens to him? Well, he stands there, grits his teeth, smiles real big, and says, "Rejoice, I'm having a trial." Ever been to the David Tomlin and the guy leading him stands up in front of you, takes out his hymn book and says, "Why do you all look so grim? Rejoice, because you're having a trial, you know, because you're fasting." Let's see you really smile. And you don't want to smile at all, you know. Who wants to smile when they're fasting? Well, what about that concept of rejoicing in trials? We'll get back to that in a minute. Job chapter 7, verse 3. Job said, "I am made to possess months of vanity." This went on for almost a year. You see, almost a year. It was a long, long trial. It didn't last a week or two. "Wearisome nights are appointed unto me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be gone? I am full of tossings to and fro till the dawning of the day." He had a terrible problem with insomnia. This is a strong man. He's not sleeping like a baby. What happened to, you know, this gutsy, strong, dynamic guy who could conquer anything, who built great buildings and ruled a whole area? You mean he had a problem? Yeah, he did. He couldn't sleep. "My flesh is clothed," verse 5, "with worms and claws of dust. My skin is broken." Verse 6, "My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle." I want you to notice the example of a weaver's shuttle, you know, moving through Job's life. I'll come back to that if I have the time. "And are spent without any hope." And he's touching bottom. This is the classic pity party. "My days are spent without hope. Remember that my life is wind. And mine eyes shall no more see good." This is depression, real depression. Going down to about verse 11. "Therefore I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." I mean, he is really down. "Am I a sea? Am I a whale? I mean, what are you doing to me, God? When I say my couch, my bed will comfort me. Then you scare me," verse 14, "with dreams and terrify me through visions. My soul chooses strangling and death rather than my life." Verse 16, "I hate it. I don't want to live forever. Leave me alone. My days are vanity. Leave me alone, God," Job said. Now, it's interesting that God didn't zap him for saying those things. He didn't, did he? He said some rather disrespectful things here. God didn't zap him. Now, God wasn't thrilled by what Job said, frankly. He was not thrilled. But he didn't zap him. If you read Psalms, you'll find David said very similar things in the middle of some of his trials. Very similar things, expressed some anger to God. God did not zap him. The lesson to learn, brethren, is that God is very gentle, very tender, and very indulgent with us when we, initially in a major trial, react with despair or despondency, as most of us will for a while, or with anger, as many of us will for a while, as the trial comes hurtling into our life. The book of Job and the Psalms are full of that precious, reassuring truth. In 1983, I was diagnosed with a cancer in the lower abdomen, and I had it removed surgically. That's 5 years ago, the 27th of December, I had it removed. It was frightening going to the hospital. I'd never been cut on before, and they removed a pretty big chunk of me. I had some very unattractive scars, which I will not show you or anybody else. That's alive. I went through it all, though, and I got, I got over it in about 3 days, and they want you out of the hospital quickly. So the third day they were saying, "You can leave now." So they put me in a wheelchair and pulled me out to the car, and I left with the doctor's voice ringing in my ears. He said, we seem to have gotten it all, and it was self-contained, and it doesn't look like there was any spread. And he said, you're very lucky. You're very lucky. Somehow, though, I did not feel lucky. Isn't that funny? I mean, they had gotten it all, he said, but I didn't feel lucky. I felt discouraged. I felt violated, and I mean that in the fullest sense of the word. I felt like a piece of meat that had been carved on, and I felt that way for about 6 months. To one degree or another, it simply didn't go away. I didn't know about post-operative depression. Nobody told me about that. I do now because I had one. But I didn't know that you do that. Now I understand postpartum blues. Women, after they have babies, get depressed. You wonder, isn't that strange? Natural part of life after a major trial or loss. And I felt like a piece of garbage for a long, long time. Well, then a few weeks later, I had some rather unusual symptoms, and I went back for some additional checks and tests, and I couldn't believe it. This was, I think, 3 weeks after the operation when I got the results from the additional test. He said there appeared to be another form of cancer that was unrelated to the first form, and the specialist felt it could be moving through the lymphatic system very, very quickly, and he recommended I start radiation and chemotherapy virtually on the spot. He said he gave me the number, gave me the specialist, and said, get over there as quickly as you can. Well, that was frightening and very disheartening. Right in the aftermath, on the heels of the operation, they got the cancer, and then they said, it looks like I have another one. That is hard to take. I remember sitting in the office of a specialist who sets up your program when you do a radiation therapy, and there were all these cancer patients in the office, in there, I guess, for their weekly or daily dose, three or four of them, and all of them were skinny and thin, and I looked at them wondering if I would look like them in 5 or 6 or 7 months, wondering if that was where I would be. And I got so, looking at them, I got so sort of just phased out by it. I got up and I walked out. I didn't break my appointment. I simply walked out and I wasn't there when my name came up. I don't know what they thought, or maybe he's probably used to things like that happening, frankly. I remember I went to a park in Arcadia, which is a couple of blocks away, and I sat on a bench in a park for about 2 hours. And I said to God in 100 different ways, God, it is not fair. It is not fair that this is happening to me. I've had it once. And once is enough for anybody's lifetime. I said, God, I know lots of people who have never had it. I know a few people who have had it once. I don't know anybody who's had it twice. And it's not fair. How can you do this to me twice in such quick succession? And I said some things to God that were highly disrespectful and untrue about his character, but I said them. And I was discouraged. I was angry, and I was angry at God. And incidentally, my session of anger lasted, more than a session, season of anger lasted a couple of weeks. I didn't pray much in those couple of weeks because I didn't want to talk to God. I really didn't. I didn't want to talk to him. God did not zap me out of existence. Isn't that interesting? Didn't zap me. Could have. Didn't. In fact, God was very gentle. You see, he knows we get a little irrational when trials begin, so he remains very involved in our life. He remains very gently involved in our life during the darkest days when we struggle with anger or with despair or despondency or discouragement and the various fears and emotions that we have, much the same way that a physical parent does with a sick, delirious child. You know the goofy things a delirious child does and says? You know how goofy they get? I mean, they'll say some of the weirdest, strangest things. When I was a kid, every time I got delirious, which was quite often, actually, I don't know why that was, but I always got delirious. Didn't matter what I got, I was delirious. And until I was about 12, I imagined this gigantic duck sitting on my chest. And, I would just sort of, out I'd go, and here was this huge duck smothering me. And to this day, I don't go near ducks. They still sort of bother me, you know. A delirious child just has these goofy things come into their mind and they'll say unusual things. You're sort of like that when a trial begins. You say and you think some real goofy things. You really do. And God just sort of carries you through all that. 1 Peter chapter 1, I want to read something. Peter clarifies it is not unusual if a certain level of depression occurs when a trial begins. 1 Peter chapter 1, in fact, it's unusual if it doesn't. It's unusual if it doesn't. 1 Peter 1 verse 6. Notice, it also hints, though, at the solution, because there is a way out of it. 1 Peter 1, verse 6, wherein you greatly rejoice. Notice, here is the joy. You do rejoice, But when do you rejoice in trials and how do you do that? I mean, that sounds subhuman. Though now, he says, for a season, that is, before the rejoicing, comes another stage. Rejoicing stage two. What's stage one? Though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness, oh, through manifold trials. So you see, there is a season of heaviness at the onset. And in God's great plan, the season of heaviness is to be followed, however, by a season of optimism and peace of mind and great joy. I do stress great joy. I'm not being, emotional about that. That is the term that I want to use because it is the accurate term and it is the biblical term. In fact, the biblical phrase is joy unspeakable and full of glory. I'll come back to that in a minute. It's a promise you can claim. And it is a very real promise. What about all the scriptures that say, brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials? How do you count it all joy? I'll tell you a couple of things about that particular process. You can't work it up, and it doesn't do you any good to go to funny movies. You can have the funniest guy in the church come over to your house and have him tap dance, get out his cane and his hat, and put on a show. It won't make you feel better. It may temporarily for a few minutes, but it'll all come rushing back. When a trial begins to roll through your life, everything in your emotional makeup, and there's a fragile side to your emotional makeup, everything there, you see, goes into gear to pull you down into what the Bible calls a season of heaviness. It really does. So you have to ask God to pull you out and literally generate and create in you by a spiritual process the joy that the Bible talks about that is a part of every trial in which God involves himself. It is automatically there as a second stage. Now, how does that happen? Isaiah chapter 61, I want to clarify quickly some of Christ's responsibilities as high priest over the church. Because he has so many things that he does as head of the church. And a couple of things, of course, in his mind are perhaps priorities more vital than some of the others. Isaiah chapter 61, verse 1, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me. You remember that Jesus Christ read this and applied this to himself in Luke chapter 4, verse 18. So this is Christ speaking, and this is New Testament doctrine, in effect. The Eternal has anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. That's the good news of the kingdom of God. Christ does do that. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted. Now, if you have a heart, a psyche, that is sort of cracked and marred, if it needs to be put back together, maybe you should ask Christ to do that because he said he would. To proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prisons to them that are bound. Verse 2 talks about the kingdom and about prophecy and about what we do as Christ inspires us and leads us to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God. That's his great commission as he works through us. But notice another side to it, a more personal, loving, caring side. The end of verse 2, to comfort, as the kingdom of God is taught, he also comforts, lifts up all that grieve. It doesn't just mean those who mourn as the end result of the death of somebody, though that is certainly involved. All those who grieve, whatever the loss is. Verse 3, and incidentally, this is real comforting. It isn't just sort of a nice little religious phrase any more than proclaiming the acceptable day of the Lord is a nice religious phrase. That's a commission that is performed, so is the comforting. He does that through the Holy Spirit within us, causing positive thoughts to come into our mind. He lifts us up emotionally, and he also sends people into our life that will comfort us. He does comfort those who mourn. Verse 3 amplifies that particular side of his commission and his job. To appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, Zion's the church, are there people mourning, grieving, are there people that have gone through major losses in life? And what are you mourning? Is there a major loss? Those who mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes. Sometimes it seems like your life is, you know, in the ashes, in the garbage can. To pull you out of the garbage can to give the beauty back, to give you the oil of joy for mourning. Now, oil is a type of the Holy Spirit. We know that, and joy is a fruit of the Spirit. That means God will place in us in a special way. This is not something that God necessarily does for us all the time. When things are going pretty good, This really is a kind of a special work that he does when things are going pretty bad. He gives us the oil of joy. That is an anointing through his Spirit, through the fruit of joy, positive thoughts placed within us when we're undergoing testing. And this is something he will do if we ask for it. It is a part of his job. The garment of praise, notice, for to replace the spirit of heaviness. So the spirit of heaviness is going to come. You know, if it doesn't come, then there's probably something a little bit unusual about you. You're a Superman. And that they might be called trees of righteousness. Notice again the emphasis on his job. Two things, preaching the kingdom of God and then comforting those who mourn. Jesus Christ does that. There's so many things I could discuss in that regard, but for lack of time, I won't. You might look at Psalms 126, the whole psalm, but especially verses 4 to 6 at a later time. If you'd like to analyze the whole concept, you can do that. Seasons of heaviness are followed by seasons of joy. That's a leitmotif. You can expect that. It is a promise. It is an anchor. You can hang on to it. Now, why did I state about 20 minutes ago that this is a major lesson you have to understand to survive trials, to make it through them spiritually intact and not to be devastated or destroyed by them? I'll tell you why, brethren. When we're in heaviness for a season, and I have been, and all of you will be. I'm not now, by the way, but I have been, so I know what it's like. We are then very vulnerable, we're very fragile, and we're just a little bit irrational. And when you're irrational, you can do irrational things. You know, we start assuming when there's a major trial that things will never change. It'll always be this way. We'll never find another decent job. We'll never find another decent mate. We'll never find another somebody to replace the person that we have lost. And that possibility can become simply untenable to us. As a consequence, people can do some rather melodramatic things to escape the trial. People have left the church to escape persecution and various burdens that are a part of our life as church members. Some have simply gone because they couldn't take the pressure. I know women who have abandoned their families and run off because they couldn't take the pressure, perhaps of a child with some type of dysfunction. Or maybe children with a dysfunction, and they simply disappear because it overwhelms them. And they're overwhelmed by their fears and their despondency and by their anger as well toward God. I remember with a lot of pain a young man I baptized many years ago who took his own life in what I would call stage one. His wife, who was not a church member, had left him over the church, and the sense of loss at her departing devastated him to the point that he ended his life. That's why I tell people, if they come to me and they say, I'm having a trial and I'm really having a rough time with it, I'm really down, I tell them, look, please understand, it is just a stage. It is a season. It happens to me. It happens to every normal person in the church. There are a few abnormal people to whom it doesn't happen, but you know, but just don't go around them and it won't bother you. You know, the perfect people are exceptions. But I tell them, look, what you have to do now is accept the fact that you're not having something unusual happening to you. You're having what is usual happening to you. What you have to do now is cry out to God, to the Jesus Christ who inspired Isaiah chapter 61, and ask him for the joy, for the oil of joy and the garment of praise. That is for an inner work through God's Spirit. And God will then begin to comfort you. God will send people into your life, not miserable comforters, of the type that came into Job's life. I mean, those three guys, he didn't need them, and I don't need them. And when we have major trials, invariably a couple of those types will come bounding over. And, you know, as one lady called me up, and she said, these people have come over to comfort me in the midst of my trial and sorrow. And she said, they're making things so much worse. Do I have your permission to throw them out of the house? And I said, no, don't do that. Just sort of don't invite them over again for a while. You know, there are people that don't know how to do this, but there are people that do. And those are the people you need to ask God to send around. The joy will follow. I don't have time to go into 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 8. That's where it talks about joy, unspeakable and full of glory. Analyze 1 Peter. You will find that that kind of joy, a positive emotion within you that you cannot have under normal circumstances, comes in the aftermath of a major trial, you see. In the aftermath of a major trial. God will give that to you and bring you out of it. That's his promise. And you can ask for it, and you can have that positive experience. Second big lesson You've got to understand to make it through the heavy trials, and this is a long one too. When you're being tested, it's natural to ask God why. But please understand, God's answer is going to be somewhat general, and in this life, with rare exceptions, you will never know exactly why. And that's where the problem lies, brethren, because we want to know exactly what is going on when something goes awry in our life. We want to know every detail. Instinctively, you see, we crave clear focus and purpose in life. All of us, all human beings do. We want purpose. Everyone on the face of the earth does. Now, obviously, when you have a major sickness or there's a loss or a death or a failure or something's gone terribly awry, it creates disorder and confusion in our lives, and we don't like that. So automatically will surface this instinctive, innate desire to find a purpose. And that's okay, brethren, because there is a great master purpose. We tend to want to know every detail about that purpose, details that God is not prepared in most cases to reveal to us. But we ignore that. We then obsess on the whys. We want to know why. Has the Father talked to Christ about my problem? And if he has, what have they discussed? I want to know it all now. Tell me why. And then you see we want to reduce it all down to one single, skinny, very clear, tight little lesson that we have to learn through this trial. And we can press a little button, say, God, I've learned my lesson, and it'll all go away the next day. Because you've learned that tight, clear, specific little lesson. And it doesn't work that way. I've tried that, by the way, and it doesn't work that way. I thought I figured out the lesson. And I told God, I've learned it. And it didn't go away. What you find in the Bible is that God's purpose in allowing trials is much broader than the mere act of teaching one simple, tight, isolated little lesson. In actuality, brethren, there are hundreds and probably thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of lessons involved in virtually every major trial. And except in general terms, you may never know and probably will never know what many of them are. Now, sadly, some people keep on asking, why? Why me? Why is this happening? What's going on? Why? Why? And you know, the answers the Bible gives, and they are the right answers, will invariably, under those circumstances, seem to be superficial and trite and incomplete and insufficient and patently inadequate. When you begin to obsess on the word why, everything becomes shallow. The ministry looks shallow. What I say sounds shallow. What other brethren say sounds shallow. What God says sounds shallow. You want the real stuff. But God may not give you what you ask for, you see. There's the danger. When you obsess on the why, if God doesn't come down, sit in your living room, and give you audibly the tight, narrow, little answer you seek, it becomes so easy to become cynical and embittered and angry and to reject God as unworthy of worship. I remember the Feast of Tabernacles, I believe it was 1982, I gave a sermon on anger, and a young man about, I'd say 28, 29, came to talk to me after the services. He was deeply troubled, and my sermon had set off some of his feelings. He and his wife had a little boy of about 3 or 4 who had a major disease that caused heavy mucus buildup in his throat, in his passages here, especially at night. So that from the day of his birth, they had to get up virtually every night, a couple of times every night, awaken the child, wake him up, unclog the passages, use these things, you know, that go down and take the mucus out, which is very traumatic for a little kid. And they had to draw out the mucus to avoid him suffocating in his sleep. And this went on night after night, year after year. It was becoming harder for him to breathe. It was admittedly a great trial, and I felt terribly sorry for them, and I tried to communicate that to them. I was also alarmed, however, because he was so angry. He was angry at the ministry because he said the ministry just gives me superficial answers. He was angry at the brethren because he said the brethren never just don't serve enough. They don't care enough. They don't pray enough. He was angry at God because God wouldn't tell him why. And he said to me, and I can pretty well quote what he said verbatim, Mr. Catherwood, he said, we know the trial is designed to teach my wife and I a lesson. I heard that word, a lesson, and my antenna went up. He said, when we learn the lesson, we know our son will be healed. He said, for years now, since he was born, we have cried, we have prayed, we have fasted, we have begged God to show us what the lesson is we have to learn, and God won't tell us. And the ministry can't tell us. He said, why is God playing mind games with us? He He says, we want to know what the lesson is. Why should this innocent child have to suffer so just because his parents can't figure out what God is trying to tell them? Brethren, I told him that God has a broader purpose in times of testing. In general, it is not one little tight little lesson or one little sin that you have to figure out that is the block to deliverance. We think that, we assume that, but that is not the case. Not the case. It just hasn't worked that way. It's far more complex than that. He wasn't convinced. I hadn't given him the magic lesson. I think I disappointed him too. He went away. 4 months later, I received a letter from his wife. It was a very sad letter. She was crying, she said, when she wrote it. She told me she and her husband were emotionally, physically, and spiritually exhausted. She said, we can't go on much longer like this. She said, I get no sleep at night. I get 2 or 3 hours of sleep. My son cries half the night because of it frightens him so much when the mucus has to be removed. And she said, and again I want to quote this from the letter, we continually beg God to show us what the lesson is, but all we hear is silence. She said, all we hear is silence. How can a God of love let an innocent child suffer so? Why doesn't he tell us what's wrong with us so we can correct it and get this thing over with? She said, I don't think I can keep on serving a God that will not tell us what is wrong much longer. And they didn't. 3 months later, they ceased attending services. I followed it up. That was about almost 4 years ago now. The little boy is still alive, but I have heard that he's deteriorating very, very quickly. He probably only has a few months, perhaps a year or so, now left to live, but they've been gone from the church about 4 years now. In sore trial, brethren, you've got to bring this word why back into proportion. You have to tame it. You have to tame it, brethren. You really do. You see, it is true that the dynamics of a trial are a kind of a school in which incredibly important spiritual lessons are learned. I know that. But the lessons are many, not few. The lessons are multifaceted, not simple. They are complex and they blend together by God's design with many, many other lessons to form inner traits of spiritual character. You can't form inner traits of spiritual character sort of through one little tiny trial. It's much more complex than that. And it all forms an intricate, complex design, much like a gigantic, beautiful tapestry. And God is the divine weaver of it all. Remember, Job talked about the weaver shuttle that is moving through his life. Brethren, there is a weaver shuttle moving through my life. There is a weaver shuttle moving through your life. And God is the great weaver, you see, of the design. I want you to notice something in Romans chapter 8, 28 again in this regard. Romans 8, 28, you've read it before, but I want you to look at what it actually says. Romans 8, 28, it says more than we sometimes assume it says. Verse 28, Romans 8, we know that all things, not some things, not a few trials, not the trials that God designs, but leaving out maybe some of the ones we bring on ourselves or the ones that Satan designs. Now, all things. And notice the verb, work together, not in isolation, work together. It means intertwine. There is an intertwining of trials and lessons that have to be learned and purposes. All things work together. There is a blending, you see. And they work together for good, long-term good to them that love God, who were called according to His purpose. There's a very complex design. And in effect, there are thousands of these threads that have to be incorporated into the weave with expert, meticulous skill. And God takes all of these things that happen to us, all of them, and He then works them together, brethren, not in isolation. Now, I grant you on occasion, you may connect various trials with various obvious lessons that you're learning. I mean, there are some trials we have, and they are very clearly connected to a certain cause, and we do learn certain lessons from them. You may see a thread or two like that, sure, that happens. But you can't see how that thread, you see, then is worked through in this design, in this overall tapestry by the divine weaver to create the final trait of spiritual character. You see a thread, but you don't see the design. You certainly don't see the overall tapestry. Some things we see, we glimpse a bit here, we see through a glass darkly. To survive a trial, I promise you, brethren, you have to focus on the bigger picture and let the divine weaver do his work and he will. Another verse in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10 that enters into this, that shows some of the intricacy and the complexity of what God is doing. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10, the God of all grace, 1 Peter 5, verse 10, the God of all grace who has called us unto his eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered a while, not all the time. That word while in Greek means a season, a little while. What happens after you suffer a while, a season? He will make you perfect. Now, there are threads there, you see. He will establish you. That's a different thread. That goes in another direction. He will strengthen you. That is a different phase of your character. He will settle you. He will settle you. More threads. More things occurring. To him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. I don't know why I've been diagnosed with cancer 2 times in 5 years. I really don't. I hope that doesn't shock you. I don't know. But I'll tell you something. I've got an awareness of my mortality that I never had before. You know, mortality is non-negotiable. I mean, we can't... once the resurrection comes, that's different. But right now, you know, we're all going to die someday, unless Jesus Christ comes first, and I'm sure he will, and before most of us die. But it's good to sort of be aware of the fact that you won't be here forever. I've been forced to stand at a lot of crossroads in the last 5 years, and they can be very scary places. You do a lot of thinking at those crossroads. I remember when they wheeled me out of my room to the operating room, and they got me there too early. So they got me to the door, and they opened up the door. They're going to push you in, and you're lying on this sort of gurney, you know, on this table, vaguely groggy. They give you a pre-op anesthetic, but you're aware of what's going on. And it was too soon. They hadn't finished the preceding operation, so they pushed me back out in the hallway. And they left me there for 25 minutes. And I just sort of lay there in the hallway by myself, and nobody was there, no doctors, no nurses, just lying, flat on your back, sort of, you know, hearing noises inside the operating room, and there's nobody there except you, and guess who else is there? God is there, but nobody else is. It's a kind of a crossroad. You do a lot of interesting thinking at that point in your life. Breaks down a lot of independence. I don't know why. I don't know why. I still ask why, but not as often. It's not an obsession now. The big question really is, how? Not why, how? How do I submit to God and let him accomplish in my life what he wants to accomplish his way, as he weaves the design, as he weaves the tapestry, as he works together, you see, works all these things together into the traits of character that he wants? How do I submit to his perfect will and to his perfect plan? I'm not perfect, but his plan is. And the design he has in the future is. How do I do that? Not why, but how. Big lesson number 3 you need to understand to make it through a trial. And this is a fairly long one, too. In times of testing, lesson number 3. Times of testing, it's natural to feel alone and to feel rejected both by the people around you and by God himself. But when that happens, brethren, be reassured. God is actually more involved in your life when you undergo a trial than at any other time during your calling. He is. He moves closer to you. When things get rough, God draws closer. He doesn't go shopping. You've seen the little sign. When things get tough, the tough go shopping? Something like that. When things get tough in your life, God does not go shopping. In fact, he monitors our feelings, reactions, and needs second by second. He is right there monitoring what is going on. Now, we as human beings typically assume God has deserted us at the beginning of almost all of our trials. And somehow our perception of God blurs and loses focus under pressure. It just seems to happen to everybody. And we feel cut off, but we aren't, you see. So you mustn't trust how you feel. We feel cut off. We feel abandoned. It quite the opposite has occurred and is occurring. Job's example, again, is very insightful in terms of this typical human reaction that we have, because he felt a greater sense of isolation from God than ever before, and yet he was, in actuality, the center of attention of the universe. You've read Job chapter 1 and 2. You know what went on behind the scenes. I mean, God is talking probably to Christ. Christ is maybe conferring with the Father. Satan is there. There's all this activity going on. And Job is down on earth thinking he has been abandoned. Sound familiar? Notice Job chapter 23, verse 8. Job 23, verse 8. If you can find Job 23, verse 8. What was Job's reaction? And we'll see God's reaction. 23 verse 8. Behold, I go forward. Job 23 verse 8. But he isn't there. Job couldn't, felt cut off. He had no real sensing of God's closeness. He's not there. I go backward. I can't perceive him. I feel cut off. God is distant. But it wasn't true. It was just his perception under pressure. He hides himself on the right hand. Verse 9, on the left hand where he does work. I mean, Job's saying, I think he's working there. I'm pretty sure he's doing something. And yet, I can't behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, and I can't see him. You see, Job felt terribly alone, and we all do when trials come into our life. We get sort of schizoid, and we assume that nobody loves us, you know. God doesn't love us. The ministers don't love us. The church doesn't love us. The brethren don't like us. Nobody comes to see us. We've all had those reactions, too, when we've had some heavy trials. You know the ditty. Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. You know, you've sung that when you were a kid. I'm going to eat some worms. Remember that? We feel very alone. And we have that kind of perception because we don't grasp what God feels and how He reacts when we undergo a trial. And we're familiar with our own reactions. We know we feel abandoned. What is the actual, what's actually happening? Notice Psalms 31 verse 7. David explains how closely God monitors our innermost feelings and our doubts and our anxieties in times of testing. Psalms chapter 31 verse 7. We get right down to this sort of nitty-gritty in terms of God's relationship with us, how He feels. Verse 7, Psalms 31, I'll be glad and rejoice in Your mercy, for You have considered my trouble. That is, You've analyzed my trial. Verse 7, Psalms 31, and notice, You have known my soul. You've been intimately acquainted with my very being in adversities. Now, we don't feel that at all. We don't feel that. We tend to assume that God has gone way off. We misread all the cues. David said, you know, you're acquainted with, you monitor my innermost thoughts in my trials. And he does. He wants to know what they are because he realizes how vulnerable we can be and how sensitive and fragile we can feel. And he wants to do something about those feelings. And he's right there. Now, verse 22 tells you, however, how we tend to feel when those things go on, you see. We know how God feels in verse 7. Verse 22, notice our reaction. I said in my haste, I'm cut off from before Your eyes. We all tend to have that reaction, don't we? Nonetheless, You heard the voice of my supplication when I cried unto You. You go through a trial. God is fully aware of what's going on. You're struggling and your questions. And He even listens to your shaky, rather unimpressive, second grade prayers. Now, He listens to them. They're not going to be the best prayers you've ever prayed, but God's going to listen to them word by word, and He'll respond, and He'll attempt to draw you into a much closer relationship with Him if you'll let Him. Oftentimes, we simply don't let Him, and that's our problem. We would rather hang on to our perception that we have been abandoned, and it's a false perception. Brethren, any time there's a major loss in your life, a job, money, a death of a loved one, something that was important to you and you can't have it, God will automatically use the opportunity to build a stronger, more meaningful relationship with you. He will try to fill the void, you know, when there's a void there in your emotions, with His love and with His affection. Please don't let a false sense of being abandoned overwhelm you and cause you to negate that opportunity for intimacy with God. Because He wants very deeply to fill that void. It's there, you know it's there, and God wants to do something about it. Verse 27, Psalm 27 rather, is another beautiful psalm with symbolism that means a lot to you when you're going through sore trial. The people who never have gone through sore trial will not necessarily find the symbolism that important, though if you remain aware of some of these things, someday you probably will. Notice in verse 9 of Psalms 27, David's human reaction, God, he says to God, don't hide Your face from me. Don't put me away in Your anger. We all think things like that. God is angry. God is mad. You've been my help, but now don't leave me. Don't forsake me. He's sort of, you know, slipping into this mentality. Verse 10, he pulls himself back out and he remembers how closely God monitors our lives in times of trial. He catches himself before he falls into it. Verse 10, notice what he says. When my mother and my father forsake me, and human beings can let you down. I mean, you can have problems with your folks. You can be persecuted by loved ones. There can be a loss. When my mother and my father forsake me, then the Eternal will take me up. Or better phrased, it says the Eternal will pick me up. And the interesting thing is it doesn't say, the analogy is interesting, it doesn't say to hold me by the hand. There are some verses in the Bible that by analogy say when you have a trial or a problem, God will hold you by the hand, or God will support you by the right arm. He uses those analogies to show His warmth and His concern when you're going through difficult times. Here the analogy is much more potent and much more dramatic and in one sense much more meaningful and emotional. Here the loss is a major loss. The loss of parental affection. I have no idea what he's referring to, but nonetheless, he was feeling that loss very deeply. Rejection by parents. And notice God's reaction as a consequence is even stronger and more personal and more powerful than usual. At times, it says in the Bible, he picks us up. Then the Eternal will take me up. He will pick me up, it means, in the analogy being used, in the way that a parent will tenderly pick up and carry a frightened, tired child. I want to read a kind of a poem that I first heard read by Mr. DeCotts. It was almost 10 years ago, and it was in a sermon he gave here in Pasadena, in fact. I just happened to be here that Sabbath, and he read this, and it moved me then. I didn't realize about 4 years later it would have a lot more meaning to me, and a little old lady in the church sent the same poem to me in 83, and I read it then, and I want to read it to you today. It's fictitious, of course, and the elements are a little bit stagey, but the lesson is scriptural and very, very powerful, I would submit to you. It's called Footprints in the Sand. There are many versions, and some of you may have heard a different version from this. One night a man had a dream. He dreamt he was walking with God on a beach beside a beautiful calm lake. Turning around, he saw behind him two sets of footprints in the sand. One belonged to him, and one belonged to God, who walked beside him. Then suddenly across the sky flashed scenes from his past life. He saw again the peaceful times and also the times of testing. As the seasons of his life flashed before him, he saw in each of them a beach and more footprints in the sand. He also noticed with dismay that at various times along the path of his life, there was only one set of footprints. He noticed too that the single set of footprints appeared in the sand during the lowest and the saddest seasons of his life. Perplexed, he questioned God. Lord, he said, you promised me that you would never leave me or forsake me. You told me you would walk with me through all the trials of life. And yet during the times when I needed you the most, I saw but one set of footprints in the sand of life. Why did you abandon me then when I needed you the most? And the Lord replied, my child, I have never left you, and I never will. You see, in your times of pain and sore testing, when you saw but one set of footprints in the sand, those were my footprints, not yours. Those were the times that you faltered, and I picked you up and carried you. I want you to think about that lesson. That is how God reacts to you when you have trials and difficulties. Please believe it. Someday, that concept, that point, that truth can save your life spiritually. Find a lesson for it that you need to understand to make it through a trial. And this one is very short and very simple and very basic. When you're being tested, we never forget that we are promised deliverance from all of our trials, all of them. I won't go back and read Psalms 34, verse 19. I'll simply quote it to you. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Eternal delivers him out of them all. Doesn't say some, says all. The question, of course, is how does he do it? Now, the scriptures teach that deliverance can come to us in various and different forms. I'll suggest three of them to you at this point in the sermon. One is closure, that is, God can simply stop the trial any time that he chooses. He can simply say, this is the end. That's what happened with Job. God stopped the trial and says, it's over. And it was all over. And his family, his wife came back. She left him, by the way. She came back. She had more children. Wonderful things happened to Job. Second form of deliverance, cessation of life. And that is a valid deliverance. It is a form of deliverance that God can use from time to time. That's not a cop-out. That is simply a fact. Jesus Christ was delivered from the pain and the agony of crucifixion through death. Third form of deliverance, the granting of inner grace. Because God can strengthen us in such a way, brethren, in the inner man that the trial becomes bearable and no longer even seems like it's a trial. The situation itself doesn't change, but we do. As one minister phrased many, many years ago, and I thought the way he phrased it was rather neat, so I wrote it down and I remembered it, and he said, and I quote, "Sometimes when a storm rages in our life, God calms the storm. But other times, while the storm continues to rage, God calms the child." Results, he said, are the same, and they are. That was Paul's experience. I won't turn to 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. God said to Paul, "My grace is sufficient unto you." Sometimes that is God's answer and God's deliverance. Through grace and inner working and granting inner strength, God strengthens us in such a way that the trial becomes bearable and ultimately no longer is a trial. In conclusion, I want to bring it all together very quickly. I want to quote to you a verse that I discovered 5 years ago. It's funny, you read the Bible for years, and then when you have a major trial, you discover things that were there all along, but you didn't know they were there all along. They appear. And you say, well, that was always there, but I never knew it was there. And it creates meaning for you and sustains you in times when you need that kind of support. Psalms 18 contains a couple of those verses that were very important to me 3, 4, 5 years ago and still are. Psalms chapter 18, verse 6. David was going through a major time of trial and testing. I don't know exactly what was happening, but he said in verse 4, the sorrows of death compassed him about, so he was afraid for his life for whatever reasons. In verse 6, David said, Psalms chapter 18, "In my distress I called upon the Eternal." And notice, "I cried unto God. He heard my voice out of his temple. My cry came before him unto his ears." And then what happened? Well, then the earth shook and trembled. Verse 8, "Then went up a smoke out of his nostrils and fire out of his mouth." Verse 9, "Then he bowed the heavens and came down, and darkness was under his feet." Verse 10, "He rode upon a cherub and he flew, yea, he flew upon the wings of the wind." To do what? What for? His child was in trouble, you see. David needed to be delivered. This was God's response to a trial in the life of a man named David. Incredible response, you see, in times of trial, with the center of attention of the family of God. Now, we don't always feel that way. We don't always think we are, but we are. Verse 11, "He made darkness his secret place. He thundered," verse 13, "in the heavens." So many things occurred. Deliverance was on its way. Verse 16, "He sent from above and took me and drew me out of many, many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy." Verse 18, "They prevented me in the day of my calamity, but the Eternal was my stay. And he brought me forth also into a large," in the Hebrew it says a wide place. And a wide place is a place where there is breathing room and there's room to recoup and there are a few pressures and things are pretty calm. I can remember reading this 5 years ago and asking God to put me in a wide place. Because when you've been told you might have 2 to 7 years to live, and you've been told you need to have chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and you're told a lot of very scary things, you began to ask God to do a lot of things. One of the things that I asked God to do was to put me in a wide place. I wasn't quite sure what that wide place would be or where it would be or what it would be like, but I knew I wanted deliverance. I didn't want to have to keep on going through those things. David asked God to put him in a wide place, a place with breathing room, and without the pressures of a major trial. And God ultimately did that. David said, "He delivered me because he delighted in me." The end of verse 35 says, "Your gentleness has made me great. You've enlarged my steps beneath me," verse 36, "that my feet did not slip." Last Thursday, in fact, I sat in a doctor's office and I watched the specialist take out my file. My file is pretty thick. There's a lot of stuff in there and voluminous. And he pulled out his sheet and he wrote on the top sheet, he wrote, "Cancer cured, no need for further follow-up." Those were his exact words. Now, you know, a lot of the symptoms disappeared about 3 years ago, but disquieting things have kept on occurring. And a couple of months ago, some new symptoms occurred. There were some enlarged blood vessels, which indicates weight or heaviness, perhaps a tumor, and they get very uptight when you've had a history of cancer. So they went on a fishing expedition about a month and a half ago. I spent about a week having, all kinds of things done to me, various and sundry things that most of you would not want to know about, especially not an hour and a half before dinner time. And they went fishing, and they found, well, they found something wrong with me, but they didn't find any cancer. And so we wrote in my file, cancer cured, no need for further follow-up. At that particular moment, I really felt I finally made it into my personal wide place, you know, because all these disquieting things have kept right on over the years. But they looked, there's nothing hiding up here, or in my big toe, or in my fingers. They checked everything. So I still have some residual problems, a couple of things that I may have to have surgery for in the next year or so. But these are not life-threatening things. These are just things that are sort of miserable. But, they won't take my life. The worst part of it, of the last 5 years, is basically over, and it's sort of nice. You know, I'm enjoying the waters of quietness, and some of you have been there all along. It's a nice place. Well, I don't like the word lucky. I shouldn't say that. I was going to say, boy, some of you have been lucky. No, you've been blessed. The waters of quietness, that's a nice location. Green pastures, quiet waters, wide places. I'm enjoying my sojourn with a lot of you in that particular season of life. But I know one thing. Just as times of peace are a part of the fabric of life, so are times of testing. That's just the way things are. And someday, tests, major ones, minor ones, will come into my life again. And I'll deal with those in whatever way God helps me to deal with those things. You see, with God's loving help, we survive. We make it through the times of testing, back into the times and the seasons of peace. Job said, and I want you to think about this in Job chapter 23, verse 10. Job said, when he has tried me, that is, when he's finished working with me, when he's finished using the trial I'm going through, he said, I shall come forth as gold. And he did. And so will you. So will you. I want to ask some of you to hang on. You know, there is always a wide place ahead. There's a wide place in God's plan for you to hang on a little bit longer, and you'll be there. It's a good place, but, it's a season of life. And these seasons in life are a part of that fabric and that design that God is working out.